Hello.
Your conference is being recorded.
Hi, Kelsey, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can. We had a few beeps, so we'll wait a few more minutes, or just a minute, I should say, before we start.
Okay.
I did start the recording because it just seems to be easier that way.
Okay. Yeah, I was actually waiting for, I don't know, about a minute before you got on, but life is good.
It is. I hope everybody's staying warm tonight. It is awful cold out.
What's the temp there?
I think we had like 26 below.
Yeah, it was colder there than here. We were about 20 below this morning.
Ugh. It's days like that that I can go without.
Yeah. But the days are actually getting longer.
True enough. Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started because it's 8 o'clock, and I want to welcome you all to tonight's call. I'm glad that we have these in the comfort of wherever we are, indoors, so we don't have to go outside into the cold weather. Tonight, we're talking about literacy for the kiddos that have a dual sensory diagnosis, and we're happy that Kathy Harstead from Minot State is part of that, part of the grant on dual sensory, and is going to be giving tonight's information for you all. So, Kathy, I'll let you know how many that we had register for tonight. There was quite a few. So you lead the way. You've done these several times, and we're appreciative of that. So if you want to take questions as you go or wait till the end, you just let the group know what you'd like to do. Also, while we're doing a little bit of housekeeping, if it gets noisy where you are and you don't have a mute button, if you click *6, you can mute yourself, and then if you want to unmute yourself to ask Kathy a question, it's #6. So without further ado, Kathy, take it away.
Thanks, Janine. Hi, everybody. Welcome to this webinar on digging into literacy for students with dual sensory impairments. And I don't know how many of you were at the last one of these I did, which was on numeracy. And there wasn't as much information out there on numeracy, but I didn't have that problem with literacy. There's tons of information that's been well studied for this population. So I'm just going to go ahead. I don't mind questions along the way. So just holler out, Kathy, and I'll stop talking, and you can ask your question. So I'm going to move on already to slide number 2. I think it's important that we all start on the same page. So what is literacy? Basically, it's the ability to speak, listen, read, spell, and write using some form of symbolic communication. So you can see the two circles on the right, that literacy itself is part of our overall learning to communicate. We're learning to communicate in a very specific way. And as you can see by the timeline I attempted to draw below, literacy doesn't start when we're in school. It really starts at birth when we are smiling at and talking to our children, and it continues throughout life. So moving on to slide 3. So what's involved in literacy? It's important to understand the big ideas. And the reason that is because even though literacy involves using symbolic communication, a lot of times the traditional ways that we teach that don't necessarily work for this population. So it's important that we understand what all is involved. So basically, it's learning to send and receive messages, communication, and then using some kind of symbols to convey meaning, whether that's an object, a picture, a sign, whatever it is. Then we learn to sequence those symbols to convey meaning. And we learn to interpret the symbols to get the meaning out of them. So it's one thing to know how to sign a couple of words using sign language. It's another thing to watch someone else do it and or to feel their hands as they make the signs and figure out what they're trying to tell you. Same thing with print. It's one thing to be able to say a word out loud. It's another thing to be able to sound out a word. So once we become people of the code, as it were, then we start learning to translate our thoughts into stories and messages. And that's where literacy really takes off. So those are some of the big ideas that are going on in the background. For students with dual sensory loss, we have to remember that a student with those kinds of challenges is not necessarily completely blind or completely deaf. They might have some available vision and hearing to help them learn literacy, and we want to use that. We want to know what they can hear and how they're using their hearing, how they're using their vision, because that's going to make a difference when we provide instruction. We're also going to tap into their tactile and haptic learning channels, maybe to a much larger extent than we would for a student whose vision and hearing is intact. Whew, that was a lot of stuff. So I'm going to go on now to slide 4. And when we think about teaching literacy, it's important that we think of the first of the traditional ways that we use to teach literacy, because that's what comes naturally to us as parents. And we want to make sure that we're exposing our child with dual sensory losses to all of these kinds of activities. So that we're talking to and with our children. They might not hear our words fully, but they feel the vibrations, and they begin to understand that there's some meaning in what we're doing. Or we are finding a way to talk to our children that's a match for how they understand the world. We're also listening to our children so that they understand that there's an adult recipient that they can influence and control. We're telling and reading stories. We're writing notes. They see us writing names, lists, reminders, birthday cards, how to do things step by step. We're writing stories. We're using labels, calendars, schedules. We're using skill worksheets for practice if we send our kids to school. And finally, we're also using tablets and computers. So we have a rich array of teaching literacy to any child. We want to make sure that we're giving our child who's deafblind the same kind of access. I'm going to take a step back now and starting on slide 5 and talk about some of the unique ways that a child with dual sensory loss learns. Through touch, the student has experiences and memories. And those memories may be very broad or limited. Just like when we see an object or we hear a song, it brings back all the memories that are associated with that, all the similar objects we've seen in the past, or events that happened related to that object or that song. For children with dual sensory loss, they have those same kind of memories through touch. And so our goal is to help the student develop and use meaningful movements first and then symbols to communicate those shared memories. Look at the little girl and the woman in the picture. They may not be speaking. They may not see each other, but there's a great deal of shared memory in their touch. Okay, going on to slide 6. So, with a child, a very young child who is deafblind or who has a dual sensory loss, we're already starting to put in the underpinnings of literacy when they're very small. And we do that through our relationship with the child. So we need to affirm first, I heard, I saw you, I felt what you did there, and then respond, I understand what you meant. That is essential so the student learns communication is not just about sending a message with a symbol, but it's about sharing and enjoying the full and rich part of being human. And we begin that with just movement, which is very concrete, and then we build toward the abstract, which is understanding symbols. Take a look at slide 7. Children's experiences leave body emotional traces in the memory. And students express those memory traces in their behavior. Isn't that a beautiful picture of a little girl with her doll? She has her hands wrapped around that doll. Look at the expression on her face. When you see this, you begin to understand how language is built in a child. We don't really think about it that much. We just pick up our kid and talk to him and hold him. But for kiddos who have that dual sensory loss, we really need to be looking for those opportunities to affirm and then interpret. So we want to establish shared experiences with the student and co-create shared meaning of a student's expressions. And then we can begin to develop gestures, meaningful sounds, and objects of reference that go along with that. And that is how we slowly introduce that child to the world of symbols. But the foundation has to be there first. So we are setting up opportunities for that student to become an active participant in life. We're looking at things from a student perspective, not just our own. We're affirming, we're interpreting, and we're taking turns with that, as well as putting in place some consistent, accessible language. And just like most of us have different ways to express ourselves in terms of symbols, we don't have to just stick to one. We can have multiple layers of that as long as we build it slowly. So we're going to go slow in the beginning when the child is very young so we can go faster later. But we're not after just a child who complies and who will follow a routine and who will do some functional tasks. We want this child to be aware of someone who shares their space and their perspective. Someone as a responder who shares and affirms their memories, their feelings, their thoughts, their needs, and someone with whom they would want to connect and share again, because that is the fundamental motive that this child is going to have for communicating. And primarily we're going to do that through play, because play gives us experiences that we want to communicate about, our play routines, social routines, comfort routines, and learning routines. So we also want to keep in mind when a child is very young that we want to have appropriate goals. So take a look at slide number 12 in the little boy. He's getting some extra help to get up on his hands and knees and crawl. And we see that a lot with young kids with dual sensory impairments because they don't have the same motivation to take initiative. Our goal for him is not that he would crawl toward a vibrating toy. Our goal is that he would get a vibrating toy and turns playing with it with a parent or a sibling. So relationships are the foundation of why we communicate. We want to build that in. We also want to, as I said in slide 13, we want to understand what the child sees, if he has some vision, how he uses his vision. Can he scan? Can he focus? What the child can hear and how they use the hearing. So, for example, when my daughter was very young, she had a hearing loss, Bill does, and her vision was fairly intact with some glasses, but what we noticed is that she often did not look and listen at the same time. Those two channels didn't integrate very easily for her when she was young. So if you were telling her something and she was listening to you, she wouldn't look at what you were showing her at the same time. And if you were showing her something and she was focused on it visually, she wouldn't hear what you were saying. She could hear it, but she wouldn't, with her hearing aids, but she couldn't take it in. So that became really important to know when you were teaching her. What do you want me to do? Do you want me to look at something? Shut up and let me look at it first, and I'll listen after a while. Same thing. So we have to know how our children are using their vision and hearing. We also want to take into account how a child moves and what kind of postural support they need for learning. Because if, as we form a relationship and we start introducing symbols that we want our child to look at, to touch, to manipulate, to sequence, we're going to want them to be in a good posture to do that. So I think I've made my case on that. So I'm going to go on. I want to talk about repetition and practice. I read somewhere that the average child hears their first word about 14,000 times before they're able to mimic it. And certainly when we're learning skills at the school age, if we had a really talented and gifted student, they might need between 1 to 4 repetitions to learn something new. Typical students might need between 8 and 18 repetitions. For a deafblind student, it really varies. It might be a few repetitions, but sometimes it's hundreds in order to build, say, a concept of what, jump means, when we can only partially get the information about what that other person is doing. So that's the background for introducing literacy. And as a child grows, they begin to notice there's all these objects around them. There's symbols, different symbols that have meaning. There's the way my mom hugs me. There's the way my dad hugs me, which is different than the way my mom hugs me. There's the way my big brother wrestles with me. But there's also tools like spoons and forks. We're beginning to get a wider idea of the world. And symbols are even more abstract than that cognitively. So eventually, as we're introduced to the world of symbols, think before the average child goes to, say, kindergarten, how many times they see letters and pictures all around them through stories that you're sharing with them thousands and thousands of times. So with a child who has a dual sensory loss, we really have to get those same experiences in through their other channels. But when we get to the point of actually teaching reading, then there's five major components. So vocabulary or comprehension, oral language comprehension, phonological awareness, so that's just being aware of sound differences, phonics, where we understand how to blend sounds together to make a whole word, and then fluency, putting all that together and moving from one to the other. As you can see, what I'm laying out is a very complex task for our brain to do. If we look at slide 16, I've kind of split that into two halves. So when we're reading, part of what we're doing is focused on the meaning. That's our vocabulary comprehension and our oral language comprehension. But part of what we're doing is code. We're focused on the code, the awareness of those sounds and the rules for how sounds come together to make words and sentences. And fluency goes back and forth between those two. So all of those integrate over time to facilitate the complex act of reading for meaning. So if we're teaching a child Braille and we're just trying to get that child to recognize when they touch the different letters, that's probably code-focused but not meaning-focused for that child. And unless it's really linked to what's meaningful and it's really linked to that child's shared memories, they're probably not going to want to do it. So what are the pathways to literacy for students who are deafblind? I'm on slide 17. Observation, and that might be through touch, of significant people reading and writing for a variety of purposes. Meaningful conversations during literacy experiences. The accessibility of literacy materials. Connection of literacy to their own experiences and interests. And regular opportunities for independent use of reading and writing material. So when we look at the group of students with dual sensory loss who eventually successfully become literate, they have to have an abundance of these pathways in their life. The ones who do become literate have these pathways. So if we look at slide 18, one of the good things about literacy is that all children can read. It's just that they might do it in different ways. And literacy has been really well studied. So I'm introducing you to the literacy website that's been put together by the National Center on Deafblindness. And it lets you, if you go there to that website, I'm just showing you a still capture of this in slide 18, you can see that there's a literacy skills checklist, and then there's a steps to literacy, how we get there. So on the next slide, basically behind this literacy model that's at the website, we focus on what the person can do at any age. So if your child is 17 and they're not literate, it doesn't mean that we can't start building that foundation. So we build a foundation, then we teach emergent literacy, then we strengthen that, then we teach reading and writing, and then we expand literacy. And you can see the skills that are involved at each of those stages. So I'm going to move on to slide 20. You know, on my screen, this is a little hard to see unless I'm not in slideshow mode. If I was in slideshow mode, it'd be easier. But it doesn't matter. You can see it at the website. But they have each of those steps. Building the foundation, early emergent literacy, and so forth. And they have some of the skills that we're teaching the child, and then the strategies that we do at that level for reading, writing, comprehension, vocabulary, and fluency. So for any student, we can take a look at this. You notice it's not tied to grade level or age, because students start at different points. Rather, it's tied to the foundation of skills that go with each step. And that really helps us make better choices about literacy. So I'm going to go on to slide 21. And I want to talk about the function of reading and writing. I think I've made the point that we shouldn't be teaching this outside of the relationship of shared stories and memories. But nevertheless, reading and writing evolved because they're a very practical solution to some communication needs that we have. And so it's important when we're teaching children the skills that I showed you on slide 20, and we're using those strategies, that we also understand the function of what we're teaching. So reading and writing helps us to organize and support memory. And how do we do that? We all use calendars, lists, and texts or stories. It helps us acquire information through newspapers, through our contacts. It's a way to code instruction in the form of recipes, directions, store rules, whatever it might be. We use reading and writing for financial negotiations, checks, bank statements, and contracts. We use them to entertain through comic books, magazines, internet, and tablets. We use it to identify things or places through signs, labels, packages. We use reading and writing to self-express and deal with emotion, from understanding facial expressions to asking for help to know which place to go to be uniquely ourselves. And we use reading and writing to create and maintain relationships. So it's a fundamental lifelong skill. No matter what level we start at, we can see and gain some progress for our students in literacy. You don't have to be a completely functional, top-notch, PhD-level reader and writer to be considered literate. So I'm going to go on to slide 22. So in school, students become literate when they access the general education curriculum. And there's a wonderful website called Path to Literacy that breaks down the essential skills that go into what we call formally in academics English language arts. So I've kind of listed those on the slide. I'm not going to read it to you. You can look at that later. So I want you to think about some of the primary concepts. I'm on slide 23 that we learn about in the primary grades. Some of the print concepts. So just the idea that we read anything from left to right and top to bottom, at least in the Western world. In other parts of the world, it's not always left to right, but here it is, left to right and top to bottom, that words are separated by spaces and that they convey meaning, that spoken words can be represented by text, and that letters are unique, and that just simply means that they need to be recognized and named. Just like people have a name or a unique sign, for each of us, so often with a student who is deafblind, each person who comes in contact with that student will use a unique sign to identify themselves. That's their name sign. If they're using sign language, if the student doesn't see or hear at all. So everything has a name. The letters have names too. And it's important to be able to refer to those when we're teaching students. So we got to be able to name them. So there has been a great deal of research, fortunately for all of us, on literacy for students who are not speaking. We don't have this system where we have to wait until a student can talk before we teach literacy. That's a fallacy. We're teaching literacy from the time that student is born. So if the student is able to speak, then we want to use systematic reading instruction where we show the student what to do, we model it, we have them redo it with us, then we have them do it again with less help. That's what I mean by systematic instruction. But one of the best ways to teach literacy is through the use of read-alouds or shared stories. We have very individualized engagements and response mechanism for each student, that they're touching, and gazing at pictures. They're selecting from pictures and words on voice output devices, that they're able to discriminate between a meaningful and a neutral or distracting object in response to comprehension questions. And then we're adapting grade level text. So even if a student can't speak, it doesn't mean they can't learn to read. So in the next slide on 25, I've listed some of the effective literacy strategies for students. So we teach phonological awareness and phonic skills using a most to least prompting and a time delay. Give the student a consistent time, and then if they don't get the answer, we tell them the correct answer, and then we do it again until they can say the answer. Even if a student can't speak aloud, the research shows they can use internal speech to learn phonics, as long as they can distinguish between I, E, A, and some of those sounds. Now, not every student with dual sensory loss can distinguish. But remember, there's a difference between what students can do and what they can show us. So we've developed techniques to teach the student to sound out words using their internal speech. They sound out words in their head, and then they select a written word to represent it. And I know usually when we're teaching reading, we have students read out loud. So for a student who's nonverbal, we can teach them to read out loud using a voice output device. We're offering very carefully planned response choices for that student based on our error analysis of how they're learning. And we're often using pointing and eye gaze as a nonverbal responding format. So if a student doesn't acquire speech, they can still acquire literacy. I can't stress enough, as we see in slide 26, that we're using shared stories to teach concepts about print. We're adapting books, and I'm going to show you some of the ways that we do that. We're looking at the overall message and the subject of the book. We might be reducing the amount of text on a page. We might be rewriting that story more simply, but with integrity. We might be adding photos or object support or tactile support, and we're making it more physically accessible to the child than we do with a typical learner. So let's look at one form of doing that. I'm going to show you in slide 27 something called a story box. So it's a book with a collection of objects or photos that can be used to provide tactile or cognitive information that's more informative and stable than the words that go out and seem to disappear into the outer stratosphere after we hear them. And handling those materials gives a nonverbal student a way to participate and begin to understand story. First this, then this, then this, then this, a meaningful end, and we're done. Which every routine that that child learns is like a miniature story. So when we're teaching the basic daily routines of life, we're storytelling with our children. So considerations for adaptations when students have dual sensory loss is how much vision does the person have? How much hearing do they have? Are either of those losses progressive? Are there medical considerations that affect learning? Are there additional disabilities? What age did the child lose those? Are there assistive devices to help with vision and hearing being used consistently? And how are they communicating when we start instruction? And when we make adaptations, we have to think about all those things. And fortunately for us parents, there's usually a great team of people surrounding that student from the time they're very young, which continues into school, that have a lot of expertise in these areas. We, as parents, have expertise on the child. So we have to work together to make sure that we're all on the same page and we're introducing literacy ideas as soon as we can. So here's another picture on slide 29. It's a little bit of a story box overview created for different learners. And you can see, if you see from the pictures, that these are stories for a very young child. These would not be age appropriate for someone who is 17, but we can still have a story box that we take out every day or every other day and go through with an older child just based on different concepts. So story boxes should be unique to the student, age appropriate, and reflect their interests. Sometimes just repeating a story over and over is how it comes to have meaning for us. So how many of us read a story 18 gazillion times to a young child? And we still smile when we see or touch the Pat the Bunny book. We probably don't even use Pat the Bunny books. I'm so old, it's incredible. But if you were my age, you would know what that meant. Okay. But repeated shared stories are very important to build the understanding. We don't just read a book once to a child and that's it. We're done with that one. And we never look at it again. We read them over and over. Also, it has to be unique to the child's level of communication. And I'm just going from slide to slide now. Starting with the concrete and building toward the abstract. And a student who's not yet an abstract thinker can still use abstract objects in the storybook to focus on the concepts. So remember, as we read, we're also building a lot of awareness and understanding of the underlying language concepts. We want to, in our story boxes, use consistency in words and labels. So we're calling it a shoe, or we're calling this a sneaker, or we're calling it a tennis shoe. What are we calling it? But everyone's calling it the same thing, so we're not confusing the child. And then we have repeated exposure whether it's through speech or computer or books or circle time, whatever it is throughout the day. All story boxes need to be unique and engaging. And on slide 38, I have some directions of, you know, just where you can get information to create or get materials to create a story box. Now, I'm talking in terms of boxes because in the box, we're keeping the book and then all these objects that go with it. And this is a really good way to engage a student with dual sensory loss in gen ed experiences as well. But after a while, as the child is able to understand more abstract symbols and ideas that are conveyed, we can move to what we call a touch book. So the book itself, or an experience book, is there, and it has a lot of tactile information in it, or bright colors, or particular colors. If a student has a cortical vision impairment, there are some colors they see more readily than others, and so forth. This particular book that I'm showing you on slide 39 is actually from a huge library of touch books that is available in Canada. And here in the United States, the North Dakota Vision Services has developed many, many experience books or touch books. And there are also more abstract books that use kind of a raised surface to outline pictures as well. So there are lots of resources out there that we can think about. So when we are doing shared stories, here are the ways that we might be working on reading skills through that story process. So we might be pre-teaching vocabulary. We might be identifying the words that are being taught and giving that student various ways to indicate that. We're embedding a lot of quick teaching trials as we go through the book. We're asking comprehension questions. Starting with ones that are very easy to answer. Later, we'll introduce more complex questions. Maybe we're rereading the text, having the student read it with us. So we keep sharing stories, we keep using books, and we work on those literacy skills. So one of the best strategies that's evidence-based, I've listed for you on slide 42, the teacher models. The teacher leads the whole class in unison responding. That really supports the student in learning the responses. The whole class provides a unison response without the teacher model. And then we're giving those students unique ways to respond if they can't voice what the word is. We're also incorporating that student's augmentative or alternative communication devices into the reading instruction. So a student can use a pre-recorded voice to participate in a repeated storyline. So if when the student is young, we're doing brown bear, what did you see? They can give the response as other students are giving the response as well. So they have a meaningful way to participate in that reading activity. Or we might be using picture communications and adapted grade level biographies as the student gets a little bit older. So if we're teaching students the meaning of particular words or the names of particular letters, whatever skill we're teaching them to sequence words for meaning. We have an objective in mind. What is it we want the student to do? We are scheduling the instruction so that it's embedded in a lot of different routines throughout the day. If the student doesn't know the correct response, we're going to give them a cue because we want to increase the likelihood that they will give the correct response, and that's the one we want them to practice. So that cue is called the prompt. Then after a while, we'll fade those out. We're also going to give the student feedback. If he says the word correctly or he picks up a card with a correct word on it or he shows you the object with a correct idea on it, however or he makes a sign for what we're talking about, however it is that unique student is going to respond. If they're correct, we've got to give certain feedback, and if they're not correct, we've got to give certain feedback. So we have to plan that out. And then we try to work that in so it's generalized across the day. And maintenance just means that it's use it or lose it. So have you ever had someone teach you how to do something, show you, and you're doing it with them, or you're kind of doing it on your own, and you come in the next day and you can't remember a thing? You didn't get enough practice to really get it into the automatic deep level. And we need that, and our students with dual sensory losses need that. Okay, I'm going to skip slide 45 just because I think I've really already covered that. And when we're adapting this process for the student, there's a number of considerations. So we can look at adapting the font size, the font type. Generally speaking, if we are using print, we want to use what's called a sans-serif font because it's easier to perceive it visually. So if you look at on slide 46, the big words there, consider adaptations. That's been printed in a sans-serif font. There aren't any little hangy pieces on there on the ends of those letters like there are if I were to use, say, Times New Roman. So we might consider modifying the number and the type of response options that the student's going to give. We're using distractor options. So that the student is picking out the correct answer. We might vary the location of a printed response card so they're not just always selecting the one on the right. We're going to sequence things from easy to difficult in making response cards. We're using error analysis, auditory cueing, where a student might have to press twice for selecting a response option, and pictures and symbols. So there's a lot of strategies that we have. And there are a number of scripted curricula that are available to teach reading to students with dual sensory loss. If you're going to use those, you got to follow the script. If you're not going to follow the script, it's not going to work. But you also have to know when to adapt it and when and how to adapt the instruction for the unique needs of the student. Okay. So here is a list starting on page 48 of a number of the published curricula that have been developed for students with dual sensory loss. These aren't the only ones that are out there, but these are some good ones. And so we can't take the time during this call to show you each one, but the Early Literacy Skill Builder, the Pathways to Literacy, Building with Stories, these are all excellent resources. And you can have a conversation with your child's teacher. They may already be using some of these. They may not. They may be eager to get their hands on it. For most teachers, working with a student with a dual sensory loss is a once-in-a-career experience. They may not have another student like that again for 20 years. So we really have to share across all perspectives what we can to make sure that everyone has the resources they need. And we're going to be reading to students at home, too, so we want to have access to some of that. So on the next slide, I just got more resources, and you can look those over on your own time. On slide 50, I'm just outlining the scripted process called Model Lead Teach Procedure, MLT, which is also known as My Turn, Together, Your Turn. Or I Do, We Do, You Do. That's a highly effective way of teaching. And I've put together a link to a video that shows someone using that script to teach reading. So you can watch it and become comfortable using those skills. It's extremely important to have continuity in instruction. I once had a parent who was struggling with a situation where the school changed their daughter's paraeducator 5 times in a single year, thinking that if they didn't do that, the student would become emotionally dependent on the paraeducator. But the fact is, if we're going to teach reading to our kids with dual sensory loss, we need very skilled instructors, and we need that continuity throughout the school day. And since students learn shared stories and meaning experiences through touch and through shared memories, it's really important for a student with a dual sensory loss to have what we call an intervener and have real continuity and delivery across the day. Then there is Braille. So for students who have a progressive loss or who have no vision, we want to teach them the Braille system if we can. And often we're working with a specialist who has learned how to teach Braille to a student with a vision loss. Now we're learning to teach Braille to a student with vision and hearing loss. So there are some differences. But I put some resources in here just so that we can get, we're going to take our lead from that specialist, but we also want to learn something about Braille and how it works because we want our child to be literate as they grow up, and it's another way through tactile input to do that. Okay, and so I've just, on the next slide as well, I have some Braille resources. There's something called uncontracted Braille and contracted Braille. And at this stage in what we're talking about, we don't really need to know those special terms. The visions, TVI knows what those are, and they can help us with that. So just kind of an overview of literacy. We're kind of digging into what this is all about for a student with dual sensory losses. And I have reached the end of my slides. No one has interrupted me with questions, but I would be happy to try to answer any that you have.
Do any of you have any questions for Kathy? I always learn something new, Kathy.
Yeah, this is a fascinating, our kids are fascinating anyway, and then it's just a fascinating area. In the picture, you see a little girl that's using a CCTV to really blow up the content so she can see it.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yes.
So I jumped into the call late, but did catch part of it. Are the program, like the rest of the slide material, going to be available that I can review those on my own and reference them to use with my daughter? And because we're actually just starting her new IEP process for kindergarten, and that we could maybe implement some of those things?
Yeah, I sent this slide show to Deneen, who I believe sent that out to most of the participants. Did you register for the call?
Yep, I did. And I did get that. I just wanted to make sure that it was still going to be available to access.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are all national sites that I put in here, so they're not going anywhere.
Okay, perfect.
You'll be able to just cut and paste those into your browser and access any of them.
Okay, mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Exciting time for you and your daughter, huh?
Yes, she's up for her 3-year, and we did some literacy work with Gigi Playhouse last year, so we're waiting to hear about this year's literacy training as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you hover over the links that are in that information that I sent out to you, it'll show you that if you click on that link, it'll pull it up for you, so you don't have to copy and paste it at all.
Oh, perfect. Even better. Thank you.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, usually on these links you have to do a control and then you tap on it to access it. If you have this thing in what we call slideshow mode, then you just tap on it. So it depends on how you're accessing it.
Any other comments or questions for Kathy? Kathy, you talked a little bit about the books that families could access. Is there anywhere that they can, like, order them to try them out, do you know?
You would contact North Dakota Vision Services.
Okay.
And some regions of our state have more of these than others. We had a wonderful speaker from Canada who came in and showed us their entire library, which was phenomenal last year. And there were a number of TVIs in the Fargo area that were getting together to make additional books to have here in the U.S. And there were TVIs there who had made books before they saw that speaker. But you know, it's just a great way to adapt materials and really engage those kids. And really, you can, you know, a school can work on adapting books, developing story boxes or touch books for the books they're going to introduce to students in a particular year. You can involve other students and help the older students in helping to create those books. There's a lot of creativity that can go into that. But check with North Dakota Vision Services / School for the Blind because they have a big library there and they have some materials already. So you'll want to start by seeing what they have. And then if you have to create your own, you can do that too.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Last call for comments, questions. Well, Kathy, thank you again for doing this. Kathy is going to have another call on the Dual Sensory Project. And Kathy, remind me which one it is about.
I think it might be Transition.
Okay. And that one is on February 20th. We also have another call, and just in case you're following our calls, we have one on the Shriners Clinic on the 28th. So if you're interested in that, that announcement has gone out, and feel free to register. So we'll have these extended learning calls is what we call them. We'll have them through probably the first part of April, depending upon when the weather gets nice, because then typically folks fall off from registering because the weather is nice, and who wants to be indoors when the temperature finally starts to improve? So,
Deneen, I saw that one on the Shriners. I thought, what a great idea, because they help so many families. So
And also, if you should lose the presentation materials or you want to listen again, we do record these calls, and then we also put them on the website. So on our website, which is www.fvnd.org, so Family Voices North Dakota abbreviated. They are all up there, and you can listen to it again or get the materials if you need to get them later on. So I will keep those there as well. So again, Cassie, thank you so much for coming on tonight, and I hope everybody enjoyed the call and learned something like I did. So thanks.
Yeah. It was nice to meet everybody. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thanks, Joan.
You're welcome.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 5 minutes.